going to try to do an awful lot, because I want to be sure we have a certain amount of understanding what happened, but also bring you up to date to the present day. So if you don't understand something, it's because I'm going fast. Please ask a question, and we'll try to keep a few things together. And what I wanted to try to keep together are these four points. Number one, if we look at the whole crisis from 1994, when you have genocide, to 1997, when you have little pieces of hope springing up like those plants that grow right after the snow melts. Little tiny things come up here and there. The landscape is still pretty barren, but with the passage of time, there's more and more green. And that's what's happening figuratively in Rwanda today, as now the country is at home again. But the first thing I wanted to point out was really the roots of the problem. Elite politics, if you like, it's a little bit of shorthand, but I think it's still helpful for us. Elite politics as ethnic politics. And if there's one thing that we, I think, if we want to try to understand with some Christian compassion, what has happened in Rwanda is that anytime a reporter told you this was ethnic violence, he is taking an incredible shortcut. And I think that's true everywhere where this label of ethnic violence gets used, as if that's a sufficient explanation for these horrible deeds. What does that say about us? This series is called The Image of God, Glimpses of God Among Strangers. What does that say about the stranger's chance to be people made in God's image, if we will believe that they can kill each other on the basis of their differences alone? Is by no means a sufficient explanation for the kinds of things that have happened, especially in a place where genocide has taken place. The second phase of the crisis in those 3 years is really the triumph of extremism. And the point I'd like to raise there as we go through it is, what happens when extremists get their way? And how do we decide between free speech and things which prepare the way for events as horrible as genocide? Some of the stuff that was on the radio in Rwanda raises that question for us before the genocide. Should you allow stuff like that to be said in society? Extremist speech leading to extremist action. And then finally, the triumph of extremism and the extreme cost paid by the whole nation for that. The third thing is the balance of suffering shift. Because at first you had, and I'll use the ethnic terms because they help us to keep things straight. In the genocide, who died? Is anybody able to say in the Rwanda's genocide?
Tutsis.
Okay, anybody else?
Hutus.
Yeah, moderate Hutus died, as well as Tutsis. Tutsis died because they were Tutsis. Hutus died because they were moderates. And that's very shorthand, but you add those two things together, and you see what the genocide was trying to do. It was trying to wipe out a people, but it was also trying to wipe out those who would object to the wiping out of a people. So it's safest to say, and most accurate to say, who the 800,000, the million, or the nobody knows how many. Probably 800,000 is a good bet. 800,000 people who died were Tutsis and moderate Hutus. But the balance of suffering shifts at a certain point in the crisis. And that's a very interesting thing for us to know. Really, it shifts from our perception of the suffering, shifts from the Tutsis, who were the victims of the genocide, essentially, and the moderate Hutus, to the Hutus as a whole, as the thing unfolded. And then fourthly, where we are today, Rwanda is home again. And I'll try to refer to these. You basically have, from here to here, you have to go back 30 years to about 1960, and actually way before that. And you'll see that a little bit now as we go through this. But ethnic politics as elite politics goes till about April 6th of 94. And then you have the triumph of extremism from April 6th for 100 days when the genocide happens. And the incredible consequences of that lead us to the point where actually the Hutu majority begins to suffer. Let me go through some of these. points, and I'm going to make reference to a couple of videos, three actually, one from the BBC. Anybody see a documentary on PBS called Valentina's Nightmare? I've got it here. I'm going to show some cuts from it, and if you want to see it later, I'd really recommend it. Incredible story. And then I'm going to use two that we made at Lutheran World Relief, one in 94 and one just recently now in 97. I had a question of where to stand in this room so you can have some light. But let me speak a little bit about elite politics as ethnic politics. Rwanda was a Belgian colony. And the Belgians used existing differences between the people to actually run the country. They used Tutsis, who were a cattle herding minority, to dominate Hutus, who were a farming majority. The difference in size is quite striking, 50%. Rwanda and Burundi have the same mix of ethnics, 15% Tutsi and 85% Hutu. There's actually, must be 84, because there's 1% pygmies who are called Twa. That same mix exists in both countries. The Belgians used it in both countries to have the Tutsis as a colonial overclass, an aristocratic class. And they did interesting little things like, say, you had to be a certain height to go to high school. Tutsis tended to be taller than Hutus. Tutsis are said to have come from Ethiopia. Nobody's sure, really. They've been there for a long time. And they've lived together in some kind of relationship more than they've killed each other. They're not sitting there for hundreds of years killing each other. That's an interesting point to think about. What makes you change from a modus vivendi, flawed though it be, to a genocide? What does it take to change from one state to another? And I think that's where we look for the answers to how this could have happened. But the precedents in colonial rule are interesting because you have essentially an ethnic politics in colonialism, don't you? You have white people coming in and pretending to run a place that they took as the leader. So the Belgian ethnic minority used the Tutsi ethnic minority to manage the Hutu ethnic majority. At one point, they said that if you had 10 cows, you were a Tutsi, and if you had less than 10 cows, you were a Hutu. And so you could move between the groups, get more cows and become a Tutsi. It wasn't a closed system. You could become an elite. They gave you name tags, and on it they said Hutu or Tutsi. So there was a hardening of the lines. I think it's fair to say that although the Africans didn't have it all figured out, and they did, one group dominated the other, the inclusion of the third party was an important straw that starts to break the camel's back and to upend the society a little bit. I don't know how much to put on that, but it certainly is important and hardly mentioned at times when you just get this thing about ethnic violence. I'm going to switch on a little bit of the first video here and show a few scenes from the colonial time. And it begins with a few seconds, the kind you'd see on the news. And I think it's interesting to juxtapose the two of what happened in 94. The narrator is saying that 800,000 people died and that the extremists had instructions to go out and kill those who had been called cockroaches, the Tutsis, in the radio broadcast that preceded the genocide. And just watch a few scenes, and these aren't pretty scenes at all. These are bodies on the street in Kigali as the genocide began. The kind of thing you'd see on the news for a few seconds. And then it switches into a little bit of historical explanation of what had happened. Could I have a light manager over there who switches things off and on?
In 100 days, more than 800,000 people were to die. Extremist radio reminded Hutus of the colonial days when Tutsi chiefs had been feudal overlords. Don't let these cockroaches make slaves of you, it warned. And then it said, the graves are only half full. Who will help us to fill them? ¶¶ understand Rwanda's genocidal madness, you must go back more than three decades to the days of Belgian colonial rule. Then the Belgians used the Tutsi minority to enforce their rule. The Tutsis were Rwanda's aristocracy. The Hutu majority were farmers, a downtrodden underclass. The system bred bitter resentment of the Tutsis, which exploded into violence as Belgium prepared to leave Rwanda in the late 1950s.
There was a great feeling of inferiority on the part of the Hutu. But I mean, this violence could never have existed if there had not been resentment, if the political violence could not take place in a climate where even those people who were not very enthusiastic about it would say, well, after all, these people, they got what they deserved. Huh? It's a little bit what happened with the Jews in Central Europe during the Second World War. I mean, when the Germans were killing Jews in a lot of Central European countries, well, the local population didn't mind so much. And I think a lot of Hutus, well, didn't mind so much that political activists would kill Tutsi. There was a climate.
When Rwanda became independent in 1961, tens of thousands of Tutsi were driven out of the country. In purge after purge, members of the minority were forced to flee their homeland, seeking refuge in the neighboring countries. Most went to Uganda, where they formed a guerrilla army, the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
Quick, the legs again. Independence. The Belgians, who had set up the system a little bit to their advantage with the Tutsis as the pimps, essentially, of the country, leave. What happens? They get democracy, and the majority commences to throw out the privileged elite. And there's a series of massacres in the years between 1960 and 1994, in which, as you saw on the map there, Tutsis are driven to the neighboring countries. And he mentioned at the very end there the Rwanda Patriotic Front, formed from refugees who were forced out, former elites forced out, lived in Uganda, and 34 years later are in the army, which comes back and takes the country during the genocide. That campaign, when they invaded in 1990, was led by a guy trained at one of our war colleges in Canvas, Paul Kagame, and his campaign is being studied at our war colleges now as a brilliant military exercise. His Tutsi general, who is now the vice president of Rwanda. And they came in from the northeast from 1990 to 94. They made peace in 1993 in Arusha, Tanzania, and the fighting stopped. Okay? So it looked like a peace agreement might carry the day, but that wasn't really to the liking of the extremists. The 1993 Arusha Accords brought a ceasefire, they brought negotiations between the RPF, which held part of the country, and the government, the Hutu-led government, who had held power since independence, okay, the majority in charge, but really an elite clique within the majority. And that's where I think the connection can be made. The Belgians were an elite who used an elite to dominate the majority. When the majority became the government, when Hutus took over, what happened? Their own leaders became an elite who, after 30 years, could not think about losing power. And when their president made peace with the RPF at the Arusha Accords in 1993, a guy named Habyarimana, the extremist Hutus, there's a group called Hutu Power, began to get very nervous that, in fact, there might be a peace accord and there might be some kind of a settlement between the two groups and they might be able to work things out. So Habyarimana, who had been an elite Hutu leader, and on top of this system, began to want to make peace, and his position began to get vulnerable. And that's where the triumph of extremism comes in, my second point. The extremists began to realize they had to take some drastic actions, and their goal became a sort of a final solution. Genocide, wiping out the minority so they wouldn't have this problem anymore, so that they could, in fact, hang on to power uncontested. they wouldn't have to worry about the Tutsis coming back and getting back their power. And I think in this phase, the extremists, when they triumph, what we're left with, for us to think about it, and we look for glimpses of God, all that's left in Rwandan society is the individual conscience. That's the last refuge of decency, of good, of any hope. Because the institutions of the society kind of implode. The church among them. Government does. The leading power is corrupted by the extremists within it. The leading party. And the rebels, well, have their institutions folded? I don't know. They're invading, so they're an enemy who is destabilizing something. And you're left with individuals and what they can do in a crisis. And it reminds me of what people said about Nazi Germany. You ever talk to a German who lived through that? And you say, what did they tell you? Did they say something about how they could have lived through the killing of the Jews?
More that they didn't recognize that it actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Others I've spoken to have said, I was in a crowd when Hitler talked, and the power in the crowd was incredible. The force of going with the flow. Combination of not knowing, of being drawn forward. And that man referred to it a little bit too, the author that they just showed. These are interesting things for us to note, I think, in understanding how it can happen. And what happens in April of 1994, after a big, long campaign by the extremists where they took over the radio station called Radio Thousand Hill, Mil Colleen, in Rwanda, and they for months and months spoke of the cockroaches. And everybody knew they meant, by cockroaches, they meant Tutsis. We had to kill the cockroaches. Softening people up with murder by words, which you can get away with. You can get away with murder by words before you try murder by deeds. And that's the tactic that they use. And the place of the radio is incredible, not only for softening people up, but also for providing the code word to begin the killing. And the word they used was feed my lambs, right out of the Bible. When the militia heard the words feed my lambs, it was time for them to start. Pull out the list that they had prepared in advance and begin killing Tutsis in every community and moderate Hutus who would be against this kind of politics by genocide. Habyarimana, for making peace, for traveling with the president of Burundi, who was also trying to make peace, was shot down on April 6th, and that's what triggered it. Within hours, the genocide began. And the best bet is that his own people shot him down, his own extremist supporters shot him down, in order to trigger the cataclysm, and in order to bump people off the fence. People who were undecided about which way to go would now be forced to pick sides once they saw people starting to get killed. Are you going to help me kill these cockroaches, or am I going to kill you if you don't? This kind of talk at every community level, yeah.
Was that shooting blamed on the Tutsis then at the time?
Absolutely, yeah. But the best bet is he was flying over an army base at the time. The army base was in government hands. And there's various eyewitness reports of people wearing berets that went with the French military aid, that handling a rocket launcher. A plantation owner near the area saw that, and there's different things like that. Nobody's ever proved it, but it's a pretty good bet that's what happened. But most importantly, what happened afterwards, 300 communes, militias in every commune. A commune is like a municipality in this very small country where 8 million people live. And also it should be said, for some of the surrounding factors, from 1960 to 1990, Rwanda's population grew from 2.8 million to 8 million. 2.8 to 8. That's more than tripling. In the country, you can drive across it on a good road in 2 hours. So it's one of the most heavily populated, very fertile. It can support 8 million people, but the pressure population is great. And I think that's an important contextual thing to remember. As the killing began, the international community almost certainly did nothing, and it actually pulled back. There were UN troops there. Most were pulled out. And a few hundred rather heroic UN troops tried to protect some lives. But for 100 days, the killings went on. And they took place under the cover of civil war, because the minute the president's plane was shot down and the killings began, the RPF forgot about the peace accords. There was nobody there. The man they'd been negotiating with was killed in that plane crash. And they went back to war. because they could see that this was an extremist ploy. So the extremists on their side and their commander said, well, we have to try to take the country now. There's no point in negotiating further. So they started pushing in from the northeast further into the country, and the killings went on. And I think it's important for us to think back to those days, because a lot of us were not aware of what was happening. And the next segment I want to play you is the kind of thing you might have seen on the news at that time. I'll just speed ahead a little bit here.
This light is blue. I'll just turn it down.
Oh, this thing is fast. Let's see if I can get the right place.
For a month, they lived and slept. With little food available.
Sorry, I'm not getting it. There's a U.S. spokesperson. Sorry, I did these on another machine. It has a different counter. Couldn't get in this room. We'll find it this way. There's the president's plane. She's getting shot down.
They have actual footage of that?
No, they filmed the wreckage later. This story that I'm not showing you very much of, the actual story of this documentary, it's about that girl, Valentina, who spent a month in the church where her family was killed. Okay. This is the U.S. spokesperson at the time.
In attempt to exterminate the Tutsis, recognizing that would have legally obliged the West to act. Instead, it took refuge in word games.
As to the distinctions between the words we're trying to call, what we have seen so far, as best as we can, and based, again, on the evidence, we have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Alan, that's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
The United States, as one of the major powers, was a signatory of the December 1948 Convention on the Repression of Genocide. If any of the major world powers would have admitted that the genocide was taking place, they would have been legally obliged by international law to intervene to stop it.
It's true that you have specific guidance not to use the word genocide in isolation, but always to preface it with this word, acts of.
I have guidance which I try to use as best as I can. There are formulations that we are using.
This was an easy way out, saying it is not a genocide. This was just wiggling out that I'm ashamed for the poor woman. She was probably realizing what she was saying at the very moment that she was saying it.
I have phraseology which has been carefully examined.
Meanwhile, the Hutu refugees who followed their extremist leaders into exile settled into camps set up by the international community. The extremists who'd organized the genocide became the leaders in the camps.
Okay, the lights again. Two points to just recap there. First, there was a convention shocked at what happened to the Jewish people. A solemn convention after World War II, 1948, on genocide, which says that if a genocide occurs, the UN Security Council, the major powers, are obligated to go in and do something about it and stop it. So they don't want to use the word genocide, because if they use it, they'll have to go in and do something about it. This is 1994 June. What had just happened the previous year that gave us a real bad feeling about what we could do in the world?
Somalia.
Remember the soldiers getting dragged through the streets?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to be a little rude about how these things balance out, 16 American lives, in effect, were balanced against 800,000 lives. Now, you may contest that we could have stopped it, but the kind of people who do genocides are not basically known for their bravery and for their ability to stand up to the light of day. If the international community had gone in there with troops, there were 5,500 African troops ready to go in, but they didn't have the equipment, they didn't have the supply. The African nations around Rwanda were absolutely incensed by what was going on, and not able to respond in a kind of a logistical manner. We argued with the UN for 6 weeks through the genocide about how much they should pay us to rent some personnel carriers we had in Europe, which the Africans wanted to use to go in or to try to do something about it. Yeah?
Who was funding the Tutsis?
Good question. Uganda. The president of Uganda, Museveni, who's now their buddy.
What's his reason for that?
They'd lived there since 1960. They'd fought in his army. They were, I think, hardworking and able to fund some of it themselves from their own earnings in Uganda and Tanzania, but also from Tutsis overseas. Other backers, I'm not so sure of. Kagame studied at our college in Kansas, the leader.
Who was funding the Hutus?
France, Mobutu, and them being in power. Being in charge of their country. The second point I want to make is that what happens, you saw at the end there are a few scenes of the refugees. That's where most of us became aware. You know, those people fled to Tanzania and to Zaire. And those weren't Tutsis fleeing genocide. Did you think they were when you first heard about them?
That's what we're led to believe, weren't we?
Well, probably. Partly by default, I think. And it wasn't real clear in the early days. I mean, a lot of people were confused. And there were Tutsis. The first refugees were Tutsis. But the vast majority, the ones who broke all the records for crossing a border in 24 hours, they were Hutus. And they weren't fleeing the genocide. They were fleeing the reprisal for the genocide that they feared would happen as the RPF took over.
Well, that they were told would happen.
Absolutely. They feared it would happen because they were led by the same people who cooked up the climate in which you could do a genocide. When they saw the battle turning against them, they turned the radio around and said, you'd better flee because of what the RPF will do to you. So the same extremists who incited the people turned around and said, uh-oh, the cockroaches are coming, watch out. They're going to do to you what we just told you to do to them. And that succeeded to the point where they had 500,000 go to Tanzania with them, they had more than 1 million go to Zaire with them. And in effect, you could call those 1.5 million refugees who fled in 94 in that summer hostages. They were hostages to the Hutu extremists who, when the jig was up, took a quarter of the country with them to protect them and to give them a power base in exile. And as it ended, the little clip, it said, and the Hutu extremists became the leaders in the camp. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly true. Mm-hmm. And so LWF, who was feeding and managing some of those camps, as well as doing other things, driving a lot of trucks around and helping with the disaster for until this day, until it was lifted at Christmas time, really had to decide, can we feed killers? It's sort of like the parable of the lost sheep. You know, you've got 99 widows and one killer. Do you feed the widows? Do you feed the killer as well as the widows? Do you let the extremists who organized the camps very well when I was in them, everybody knew what commune they were from. They lived according to the same communes they lived in Rwanda. And the killers were both able to provide efficient food distribution, but also to keep food for the army, which fled with the refugees. So you had an incredible humanitarian dilemma. And some agencies pulled out, they wouldn't do it, they wouldn't stay. Others decided to stay. And I don't think there's an easy answer. It's a little bit like Iraq. Do you punish the people of Iraq to get Saddam Hussein? Do you punish the people of North Korea because you don't like their government? Mm-hmm. Do you punish the refugees because they're in the hands of the extremists, because they're hostages? And different agencies come to different conclusions. But this is a question the church maybe needs to struggle with a little bit. Because otherwise it's too easy to sensationalize and say, oh, they're all killers. They're all African wild people, you know. And there were horrible reports about the camps. But when you go to the camps, you've had a much more nuanced experience. There isn't time to go too much into this phase, but I'll just tell you one story. And for me, it was a glimpse of God. I don't have it on film, but a man that I met in one of the biggest camps in Zaire was just standing by the little path in a camp of 250,000 people. An old man by himself. And as I talked to other people in the area, I kept seeing him and noticing him. And I asked them, one of the families, who is this guy? And they said, oh, he doesn't have any family. These are all Hutus now. These are the hostages, right? In Goma, Zaire. And they said, he doesn't have any family. But that family there, and they had a little bit nicer grass house. It had two rooms in it. It wasn't just a hovel. They made a sort of a suburban house instead of a inner city squalid one. They said that family lets him sleep with them at night, and he hangs around during the day, and then he goes and sleeps there at night. And this man had just like a person almost dead standing up, like nothing was going on in his life. So I asked him to show me where he slept, and he stepped into the house with me. It was only him and me. The interpreter stayed outside for a minute. And I took off my coat and I gave it to him. And his face just sort of like blossomed, you know? It's like, there's life here. This is a human being. And it's like, it felt, I heard about him being on the move for 6 months up to that point because he fled within Rwanda as the RPF advanced. And then he fled to Goma, and then he was living 3 months in the camp already. And the fact that somebody was there, somebody, you know, came into his life with something different than what had been happening to him. Tiny little thing. But it was as if an angel stepped into the hut with us for that instant. I couldn't talk to him. But who is he? Who was he? What happened to him now? He's part of this soup that we pass over with those seconds on the evening news. And there are countless stories like that. I saw a truck full of soap and quilts go to some people who hadn't had a change of clothes. They were clothes, quilts, and soap. Hadn't had a change of clothes or seen a bar of soap for 3 months and had been on the run again for 6 months. Hutus again, who'd fled to Zaire. I said the balance of suffering shifts. What happened is the 800,000 died with very few witnesses in Rwanda. When these hostages were forced to the neighboring countries, then the world noticed. And the cholera, the people dying of cholera in July of 94, that was only then. The worst of the disaster was long gone. But 12 days after that woman wouldn't say the word genocide, Clinton comes on TV and says, we're going to help. And they brought in the water purification teams to Goma, and they saved a lot of lives. They responded to the cholera. The international community started spending $1 million a day on these refugees and was to do that for the next 2.5 years. But the suffering of the people in exile became so heavy that you had a whole another layer on top of what had happened. And the chance to help Rwanda inside Rwanda was virtually lost, according to the Tutsi government of Rwanda today. They say, why don't you help us? You're helping the camp so much. Why don't you help us make this country good again? But the international community's attention was focused on Goma and on Tanzania. And then, remember what happened in November last year? December last year? Well, this didn't get very much play, but it worked its way out through about April and May now, and became the resolution of the crisis, and that's what I'd like to focus on. Having all those Hutus in Goma, in the eastern Zaire, destabilized Zaire. because there are also Tutsis living there from before the white people drew the boundaries. There are Tutsis living in Zaire, and having the Hutu refugees there and the Hutu extremists made it tough for the Tutsis of eastern Zaire. And the government of Zaire went along with that enough to say that all Zairians of Tutsi background were no longer citizens. Some had been there for 100 or 200 years. But under the influence of this kind of politics unchecked, the problem began to seep into Zaire. And as the local Tutsis were faced by this repression by the Zairean authorities, they rose up and started fighting. And that's what happened in November. And you had these rebel movements starting in eastern Zaire. And it ended up in the capital, kicking out Mobutu 7 months later. So they conquered this country, which is the size of the USA east of the Mississippi. Zaire is as big as the USA east of the Mississippi. And unrest among the Tutsis, triggered by these problems, grew into a general rebellion against the dictator, Mobutu, way off on the other side of the country in Kinshasa. And so the Rwanda-linked story grew into something different, and that creates a whole other chapter, which we won't go into. But as those Tutsi influenced rebels, and they were Tutsis and supported by Rwanda and Uganda, as they advanced and freed various cities, they came to these huge camps around Goma, and there was a standoff. And as they pressed, the Zairean army fled. I mean, the Zairean army was totally unpaid and unreliable and known for living by looting, essentially. They fled in the face of these rather well-organized and driven rebels. As they came to the camps and as the rebels pushed in, the extremists in the camps, a camp of 250,000, the one where I met the old man, was the key place where this happened, but also another one of 250,000 and another one of 250,000. There were 750,000 people around Goma. The moment came, some of the camps empty, but in Mugunga, the biggest one, the people finally said, when the extremists said, we have to flee further into Zaire, trying to take the hostages with them. The majority of the people finally said, no, enough. We're not going to flee with you. We're going back to Rwanda. 2.5 years later, and in the space of a few days, 700,000 people came back the other way. And those who didn't went on to suffer a great deal. Fewer hostages, if you like, but still many, many women and children and men who probably weren't killers, but they somehow still decided to move with the killers. And they fled from Goma. We almost need a map, but if this is the size of the eastern USA, Goma's over here. They fled like this, they fled like this, and you might have heard a town called Kisangani, which is the capital, provincial capital up there. And they tried to get across the river there into even other countries. They were caught by the rebels, they were stopped by the Zairean authorities. Many of them began dying in the jungle as they marched. And in the last, say, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, LWR has been part of a group which is helping to fly them home from Kisangani to Kigali, and then resettling them within Rwanda. And I'd like to spend some time on that resettlement option. What happens when all these people come home? What happens when 750,000 from Zaire, 500,000 from Tanzania come home in the space of a few days? The ones who left because the extremists told them to. The ones who were accomplices in the genocide, if only by their silence, if only by being Hutu. What happens when they come home? Well, the question of guilt and innocence comes up very quickly. One of the men coming across the border from Zaire said to the LWF's director in Rwanda, he said, I'm glad to be home. I'm ready to answer for whatever I've done.
And we all knew very well that among them there were murderers, there were people with
and I think that the thing to consider for yourself is, what would you do if these murderers
we
came home?
We have the radio telling us to be strong and to cut down the tall tree.
Okay, this guy is confessing. He's like the man who said to the LWF director, I'm ready to account for whatever I've done. This man was one of the killers, and as 100,000 people sit in Rwanda's jails, they arrested about 60,000 before the big return of December and January, and then as people came home, they have gone around and arrested more, and there's right now 100,000 people in Rwanda's jails to be tried by the Tutsi-led government for crimes related to genocide. And they've tried about, last count I heard was about 40, and handed down about half of those got death sentences. Meanwhile, the International Tribunal in Tanzania, which is supposed to do for them what the Nuremberg trials did after World War II for the genocide of the Jews, International Tribunal in Tanzania hasn't done anything, basically. They've started a few trials, but they haven't come through with any convictions or acquittals. So it's very much still, this whole dilemma of genocide is very much still on the hands of the Rwandans. And listen to this man, who is one of the few who breaks across the barrier of guilt and recrimination, revenge, of the huge chasm created by these deeds, which makes the ethnic differences ever more troublesome and it makes it a lot harder to solve. Listen to what he says.
So we, their relatives come and bring them food.
The relatives feed the prisoners in prison.
Close by, hidden from the view of his fellow prisoners, we found one man making a confession to the prosecutor. His name was Dennis Bagaruka, and he was one of the butchers of Nyarubuye. Eyewitnesses say he was an enthusiastic killer, though he claims otherwise.
It was tiring work. If you didn't go, they would beat you or fine you. Therefore, it was compulsory to go. Even if you were ill, you had to go or ask for permission to be excused. It was an absolute order.
I know that you have 8 children of your own. How, in God's name, can you then help to kill children and to kill their parents? How do you do that?
You see, all these people in the church had children. Some carried them on their backs. No one survived. Everyone was killed. We couldn't spare the children's lives. Our orders were to kill everyone. What makes me saddest is that I myself was an orphan. When I was young, I was looked after by a Tutsi man. He was only the first to die in the massacre. When I think about him and other Tutsi friends with whom I used to share everything, who are now dead, I almost become crazy.
One thing is, I feel very scared knowing he is my neighbor. Because he killed, I now feel he will kill again. I am not the only one who is scared. It's the same for others.
She's a Tutsi who stayed, survived and stayed.
He was living across there in those houses.
Dennis Bagaruka came back from Tanzania to find that his old house and his small plot of land had been taken over by Tutsis. Now his wife and family live in a makeshift hut nearby. For the Hutus of Nyarubuye, the world has been unhinged. Now Bagaruka's wife insists she was ignorant of the slaughter.
The men kept this as their secret. He never told me anything when he came home. There were bullets coming through the banana trees, but I didn't know they were killing people.
The government says it doesn't blame all Hutus for the genocide. But in the news, it's wise to denounce her husband.
My husband should be punished. When someone commits a crime, they should be punished. I don't dispute that. And I'm very happy he admits he committed a crime.
I'm very happy he admitted he committed a crime. Where's the church in all this? LWF has stayed there.
Scope is the acting.
LWF has stayed there through the whole period. Coming in very quickly, I said the other day that CNN flew into Goma on an LWF plane. Being there from the word go, long before it became news here, 6 days after the president's plane was shot down, they were already helping refugees in northwestern Tanzania. They stayed in Rwanda through the period of all of the hostages in exile, and now in the return, we're very much involved in that. The Tanzanian army did something you're not supposed to do in December. They actually nudged the refugees home from Tanzania. After the ones from Zaire had returned home, when the camp was under siege, as I just explained, nothing had happened in Tanzania like that. Tanzania has been stable and incredibly generous, including the Lutheran Church of Tanzania. Incredibly generous with refugees. At one point, refugees from 11 countries are living in Tanzania. And it's one of the poorest countries in the world. But the army decided they would send them home, and the Tanzanian government picked three agencies to stay with them as they sent them home, and LWF was one of those. It's rooted in Tanzania, it's been there for 30 years, it's helped Tutsi refugees there since 1960, and has a big record now with the Hutu exodus and return. Well, they got sent back, and this next clip is from a video we did as part of ACT. ACT is an inter-church aid coalition for emergencies, action by churches together, and LWF has been a leading agency for that effort on the ground in Tanzania and Rwanda. And you have this same situation of people coming home and finding their house occupied. Because when the Hutus fled, the Tutsis came home from Uganda and Tanzania and moved into the houses of those who went away as hostages. So when they come home, they find their houses full. And these are the two sides on the two sides of this incredible alienation of all the politics and stuff we've been hearing about.
What's the current ethnic split? Is it still
85-15? I think it's still 85-15, roughly.
Even after 800,000?
Well, that many have come home from Uganda and Tanzania, who would have been counted in the first. And then a bunch of Hutus have died. Somebody ought to do the tally on the whole thing if we want to do numbers, but the numbers are almost meaningless, I think, for us to grasp what they mean.
Who's deciding who goes to jail?
The Tutsi-dominated government.
Okay.
See, and there's a question. Can a well-intended but definitely partisan group bring justice to a country this divided? I would say the chances are very slim. And that's where the failure of the international community to have a vigorous and well-funded and well-supported tribunal is really a crime. They wanted their own tribunal. Well, this is part of, this may be seem like heavy-duty news to you folks, or not that interesting on a Tuesday morning in Holden, but all this news you hear about not paying your UN dues, the U.S. not paying, this is part of it. If we would support the UN and make them be more efficient, sure, make them reform, but support them. The UN could do an international tribunal. You'd have a chance for international law that was above national craziness. At this point, national craziness has had the last word. The Rwandans, black people, get a section of the Bosnia War Crimes Tribunal to work for them. And it's housed in Tanzania, and it's been mismanaged, and it has been unproductive. The Bosnia Tribunal is sitting in the Netherlands, but it can't get its hands on very many people because the IFOR troops aren't allowed to grab any war criminals in Bosnia, Karadzic.
They actually did last week.
Did they grab somebody?
The IFOR troops actually got a Croatian, not a Serb, but
okay,
a Croatian.
That's okay.
And it was news, at least in Canada, that they had actually apprehended one of the major players.
But unless they see them and he shows them their ID, they're not going to grab him. That's the present rules of engagement. Okay, Rwanda is dealing with not even that much interest. So you essentially have the government saying, we're going to have to try these folks. Will they be able to bring justice? I don't know. Watch this now. It talks a bit about what the church is doing, and it strikes me how important what they're doing is, but how many big questions
there are. They arrived in school over Tanzania.
These are when they just came home.
LWF workers registered thousands of arrivals each day.
So the Hutus coming back from Tanzania.
After all the rumors of revenge, many returnees feel relief at the reality they find here. Gloria's runs the ACT Supply Center, and she hears the same story from the returnees each day.
Once they return, they feel, you know, they can see we are welcoming them nicely, and they feel at home. And most of them, when I talk to them, they tell me all their... They are very happy to find things that they didn't expect them to be.
But the reality is bleaker. This is a repatriation, not a welcome. It's a return to the scene of a crime. Some are guiltier than others, but in a land bereaved by genocide, even the innocent are tainted by blame.
It's not as if they're coming home from a natural disaster or even a civil war, which that enough as it is. This was a planned, organized, calculated genocide. And I think one of the key things in order to achieve reconciliation, which is going to, in itself, it has taken a long time, is that justice must be done, and justice must be seen to be done through the due process of law.
But here, they're just people in need. LWF staff are concerned with the practical task of assisting the returnees to complete their journey. Returnees are given 3 months' supply of food and oil. Each family also receives a hoe and plastic sheets for shelter. These are vital, for many will find they no longer have homes. There's a critical housing shortage in Rwanda. Gutted by war and ethnic malice, many dwellings now lie in ruins. Most incoming returnees' houses have been occupied by genocide survivors whose own homes were destroyed in 1994. Take Mary. Widowed and made homeless in the genocide, she's taken over the house abandoned by Didas and his family in 1994. But after days and nights on the road, Didas has come back to reclaim his property. The law says Mary and her 6 children must leave. But these 2 families have found a more neighborly solution. Mary has cultivated the farm in Didas's absence, so he's invited the widow to stay until she gets a home of her own.
When we arrived and found people living in our house, we were really quite relieved. After all, if there had been nobody here, the place would have gone to rack and ruin. The banana plantation would have been completely overgrown.
Francis, an LWF community worker, visits the site of Mary's vanished home. Here, Hutu killers murdered her husband and 2 of her children. Then they destroyed the house. Building homes for people like Mary is top priority for ACT. Francis shows Mary the new home ACT technicians are building for her.
How do you feel about it, this new house the LWF people are building for you? Is it what you want?
Yes, it's really good. I feel happy about it. It'll be nice to live near other people again, because all my old neighbours are dead and gone.
All these houses are for widows. There's water nearby and a school built by LWF. It's a mixed community reflecting the new One Nation ideal.
Nowadays, we don't call people Tutsi or Hutu. We just don't say this. Our policy is we are all Rwandans. We must live together and share everything. Without saying, this is a Hutu, these are Tutsi, they are Twa. All are Rwandans.
Get the lights again.
The
new government has, as he said, has a policy of not using those old words. I'm just talking about Rwandans. The question is, will they succeed? We can hope so. The church locally was just as split as the society. Rwandan's a very Christian country, and it's been just as split as the society by the genocide. The leaders discredited because they chose sides. Some chose to flee, some chose to stay. Few chose to speak up. Many of the top leaders were actually on some of the government councils and very much a part of the system. Church leaders at that time said they didn't do anything because they were comfortable and they were afraid. Today, the church is coming back. But the international church is there doing things like this. There's a neat story from one of the resettlement places where the returnees are invited to build 6 homes. The leaders of 5 families go in to do the work, but they're asked not to build 5 homes, but 6 homes. And they build one for each of themselves, and they build a 6th one to give to a vulnerable person or family, the family of a widow, the people who couldn't build the homes themselves. Efforts are being made like that. In another example, and they referred to it briefly, LWF will help to start a school, but on the condition that everybody in the community contributes to it, both Hutu and Tutsi. Very practical efforts are possible and very important. Getting a home for Mary means she doesn't have to live in the returnee's home anymore. She can live in a home that she was destroyed in the genocide. Others who came back from Uganda can live in a home of their own. Those are practical arrangements that I think make life possible. But what are the gaps between that kind of work and really solving the problems of the country? How easy would it be just to sort of gloss things over? You know, how many people are like that Dennis Bugareza, the man confessing? And how many of us would have the courage to be like him? I think is a question for us. Yeah.
What do you think is the new president?
Of
Rwanda? Yeah.
Well, from what I know, they have been behaving relatively impressively and going beyond rhetoric and trying to reach out. At the same time, keeping a very tight hold on things and having to fight insurgents who are coming in still from Zaire. And there's a whole quarter of the country where aid workers don't go, except maybe during the day, because that's near where the camps were in Zaire, and there's still extremists coming over and army going in there and shooting them up and shooting up villagers as well. So it's a real, I think they've done well, they've performed well, but there are too many open sores still for them to do it by themselves. Yeah.
You mentioned some of the countries around Rwanda, like Burundi and Zaire, that have a Tutsi and Hutu population also.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other countries in that area that are seeing some similar kind of tribal strife?
Burundi, absolutely. And it's a whole story of its own that hasn't ever exploded into the genocide, but you have a Tutsi minority hanging on by the skin of their teeth and with a great deal of violence. Great deal of violence. You also have regional peace conferences. You know, Africa has been basically, I think, abandoned by the outside world on these kinds of things. And they're picking up the pieces themselves to a degree. And they're having regional conferences. The leaders are getting together. They put an embargo on Burundi to tell the minority government you have to bring democracy. So there's hopeful signs there, and the church is part of that as well, trying to be honest about what this stuff has come from, even though we had a hand in creating it, I think. The French role is incredible. We haven't talked about that at all, but the French role behind the Hutu extremists is rather depressing, and behind people like Mobutu. And right now it's sort of a hands-off by us and by others. A little bit of aid, yeah. But the church and the NGO presence, non-governmental organization presence, is a real important sign of the international community's concern. The politics have to be settled locally, I think, in the end, and maybe that's a good thing at this point. The LWF there, who LWR supports and since we send aid to them, talk about removing obstacles, offering opportunities for reconciliation. But none of the people there in our kind of work pretend that we can bring reconciliation. You know, what is the genus of reconciliation? Where does it come from? Where does real reconciliation come from? What do we know about that?
Within each person.
I think so. And with God opening up the chance for forgiveness. That's why I'm struck by that man who confessed. And many others whose faces are just as hard as they were in the camps when I saw them, when they were freshly, just fresh from the genocide. You could not look in their eyes. They wouldn't let you. They were too scary. Men, young men in the camps. And some of the ones in prison are the same way. They're probably angry as hell that they're in prison, and maybe they're not so guilty. But many people have been arrested. But that man has broken ranks and confessed.
What is his future for having confessed? Will he be put to death?
I don't know. That's maybe one of the big questions, whether there'll be clemency. They've sentenced a bunch of them to death, but the ones that I know of, and I haven't been able to follow every case at all, but the ones that I know of have been pretty unrepentant. If you're unrepentant, you're going to get sentenced to death by the Rwandan government. I don't know of a case like his. Within Rwanda, some signs of hope. I think our time is up. I've been pointing to a few of them as the church does what it can, as the local church comes back to life. Many Rwandans have taken in children who are homeless, orphans. Many individual Rwandans have dealt with, I think the count at one point was 800,000 unaccompanied minors. If you added them all up in Tanzania, in Rwanda, in Zaire, and many of those have been brought into homes. Others are in orphanages, others are still struggling. The examples of collaboration in rebuilding. But I also think that it's important to notice just the faces. Did you see any difference? Like say that the man confessing and then the woman saying how they feel welcomed when they can see that we're not going to hurt them. I mean, there was a brightness, a freshness there. It reminds you that life is stronger than death. Life can come back even after genocide. People are able to step forward, leave something behind. We're just working on a video that's going to be on PBS later in this year, and it's about a Ugandan refugee singer who went back for the first time to his country, Uganda. He fled during Idi Amin. And he sang his way back through Liberia and Rwanda and then Uganda. And he was in the camp where people were coming back from being flown back from Kisangani. These are the last of the returnees. They're still happening in dribs and drabs today. And they are absolutely the most despised of those who fled because they stayed out so long and preferred to die in the jungles of Zaire than come back in December when they could have come back with the rest of them. So they arrive at Kigali Airport on the UN plane, and the LWF takes them, gives them supplies at a transit camp, and then they try to find where they came from and bring them back to their home communes. Well, this singer was in that transit camp, and there were 500 children there, unaccompanied children, in the transit camp. And he said, and for the video he had, the idea was that he sings and shares some of his refugee songs with these refugees to try to understand them better. And he looked at that camp and he said, I can't sing for these people. I have nothing to say to them. You know, there's nothing I can do that can respond to what they have been through. But after a while he decided, he pulled out a guitar and he sat in the corner and he started singing. And 200 or 300 kids gathered around him quite quickly. And he had asked them who they had lost. And they said things like, I've lost my family, but here in the camp, I've made this friend. And they brought him the new friends they had made to replace the ones that they had lost back in the jungles of Zaire as they fled. And Samite was moved by this, and he went home and wrote a song, which they recorded then as he got to his own home in Uganda. And I don't have the words verbatim back at the office, but it's something like every child has a song inside of them. Because as he played back at the transit camp, the children started to dance and sing and forgot what they had come from. Enough to do that. Enough to live out the hope that is in all of us. And he's saying every child has a song inside of them. He's sure of it. All we grown-ups have to do is give them the space, give them the peace for that child, for that song to come out.